So today we're going to go over two suttas. The first sutta is going to be about mental proliferation, papancha. And the second sutta, it will be like a guided meditation. So when I tell you to, close your eyes, and then we'll go over that sutta. So the first sutta is Majjhima Nikaya 18, the Honeyball Sutta, Madhupindika Sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavatthu in Nigrodha's park. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kapilavatthu for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Kapilavatthu and had returned from his alms round, after his meal he went to the great wood for the day's abiding. The day's abiding meaning meditating for the rest of the day. And entering the great wood, sat down at the root of a bilva sapling for the day's abiding. Dandapani, the Sakyan, while walking and wandering for exercise, also went to the great wood. And when he had entered the great wood, he went to the bilva sapling where the Blessed One was and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side, leaning on his stick, and asked the Blessed One, "What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim?" Dandapani was the Buddha's, I believe, maternal uncle. And he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder against the Buddha because he had married his daughter. And obviously after leaving and so on, he didn't really like what the Buddha had done. More than that, the Buddha... Dandapani was also someone who did not subscribe to the Dhamma. He was always challenging the Buddha. He subscribed to other views. So when he says, "What does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim?" It's a polite way of saying, "What do you know?" "Friend, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world with its gods, its maras, and its brahmas. In this generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people, in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being." So here Dandapani was trying to get the Buddha into a debate. And the Buddha says, "What I teach and what I assert is basically not to quarrel anyone. And the reason is because the perceptions no more underlie that Brahmin." Now when he says Brahmin here, he's referring to an arhat, one who is fully awakened, who abides detached from sensual pleasures, no longer is interested in sensual pleasures, no longer is affected by sensual pleasures, without perplexity, no more doubt about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, no more doubt about what is wholesome and unwholesome, shorn of worry, no more restlessness and remorse, free from craving for any kind of being, no more craving for jhana, craving for formless realms, craving for existence, craving for non-existence. In other words, all fetters are gone in such a being, in such a mind. When this was said, Dandapani, the Sakyan, shook his head, wagged his tongue, and raised his eyebrows until his forehead was puckered in three lines. Didn't like that answer, did he? Then he departed, leaning on his stick. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and went to Nigrodha's park, where he sat down on a seat made ready for him and told the bhikkhus what had taken place. Then a certain bhikkhu asked the Blessed One, "But Venerable Sir, how does the Blessed One assert and proclaim his teaching in such a way that he does not quarrel with anyone in this world, with its gods, its maras, and its brahmas, in this generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people? And, Venerable Sir, how is it that perceptions no more underlie the Blessed One, that Brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being?" Bhikkhu, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here, these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. So let's unpack that a little bit. It will be unpacked through the sutta, but just so you understand. As to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person. So in other words, as to how this mental proliferation arises. If nothing is found there to delight in. So again, whatever experience we're having, if you see everything as being impermanent and impersonal, then the mind automatically doesn't hold on to it. It just sees it for what it actually is. That self-conceit, that little I that's there always in the mind, is not present to compare. That this feels good to a me, or that this feels bad to a me. That this is painful to me, or this is pleasurable to me. Instead, there is the observation, the mindfulness that says, or the awareness that says, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant. Just tweaking that a little also is a good exercise in your mind. Divorce the I from the experience. Whatever is pleasant, whatever is unpleasant, whatever is neutral, in your mind, wherever there is the notion, this is pleasurable to me. This is unpleasant to me. This is me, or this is neutral in my mind. You can switch the language and say, here is a pleasant feeling. Here is an unpleasant feeling. Here is a neutral feeling. Just that little switch as an exercise can show you how it changes, how the mindset is based on having the eye, and based on just seeing things as they actually are. So if nothing is found there to delight in, that is to say, how does one delight in it? How does one welcome and hold on to something? There needs to be an I. There needs to be a me there to hold on to something. If that is gone, then that is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, to aversion, to views, to doubt, to conceit, to desire for being, and to ignorance. These are the underlying tendencies that bridge feeling to full-blown craving in the line of dependent origination. If the mind doesn't have that self-concept, doesn't superimpose an I to an experience, that happens almost automatically in most minds. You know, they see something and they immediately compare it to, how does it affect me? How does it affect that sense of me? But if you just let go of that and see things as they are, then those underlying tendencies don't arise. So what are these underlying tendencies? In the case of a pleasant feeling, the underlying tendency towards wanting that, towards owning that, towards possessing that arises, towards holding on to it so that it doesn't slip away because it feels good to the me. That happens when there's a pleasant experience. In an unpleasant experience, the underlying tendency towards aversion arises. This is painful to me. Get it away from me. Push it away. I don't like this. The underlying tendency to ignorance can be beset in the pleasant feeling, the unpleasant feeling, and the neutral feeling. So these first two, underlying tendency to craving and to aversion, respectively, are for or underlie pleasant feeling and unpleasant feeling. But the rest of those underlying tendencies can underlie any quality of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The underlying tendency to views, having wrong view about this or that, primarily saying that this feeling is me, mine, myself, having the idea that this feeling is permanent, these different kinds of views about it, or even in general having opinions about the experience. That's the mind that always notes what's going on. That's the part of the mind that always judges what's going on. If you notice the mind is starting to judge what's going on, siksharit, let that go. Come back to a mind that's quiet and just quietly observing everything. The underlying tendency to doubt. Doubt about what? Doubt about what is wholesome and unwholesome. It can lead to confusion. Not about what the pleasant experience is or what the experience is in general, but in relation to, is this beneficial for the mind's development or not? So doubt, not in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, but doubt in relation to what is wholesome and unwholesome. The underlying tendency to conceit, right? That is primarily saying, this is me, this is mine, this is myself. That's dependent upon having self-view. Taking one or more of the experiences, or one or more of the six sense bases, or one or more of the five aggregates, or one or more of the contact, the feeling, the perception, the intention. Taking the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness, as this is mine, this is me, this is myself. The underlying tendency to desire for being. You see a pleasant experience, or you have a pleasant experience, and you say, I want this to continue. I hope this never ends. Right? Or if it's a painful feeling, you say, I hope this goes away. The desire to be this or to be that, to be away from that, or to be more of that, to possess more of that. And then the underlying tendency to ignorance, lack of mindfulness, lack of awareness of the experience, which leads to ignoring the Four Noble Truths, understanding the three characteristics, or rather not understanding the three characteristics of this experience. And so when all of this ends, when that self-concept is not present to judge what is going on in relation to an experience, then that is the end of resorting to rods and weapons of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here, these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Why? Think about when you are in an argument, or think about when somebody abuses you, when somebody shouts at you. What immediately happens? There's that sense of, I, how dare they speak to me like that? Don't they know who I am? There's that intrinsic sense of I there. It feels hurt. It feels criticized. It feels judged by. So when that I is gone, when that sense of self-concept is gone, how does it go? Using right effort. Somebody abuses you. Somebody shouts at you. Before you react with the I, take a couple of seconds. Easier said than done, I know, but it's practice. Take a couple of seconds to recognize the upshot, the percolation of the I coming up and trying to defend its view, defend who it thinks it is, defend the personality, defend that ego. Notice that happening. Relax. Let go of the I. And then you respond, and that response will be rooted in wisdom and compassion. When somebody shouts at you, when somebody has conflict with you, they expect you to react in kind. The fact that you don't, and you take that couple seconds pause, confuses them. Maybe they don't know it in the beginning, but it kind of confuses them in their mind. This person is not returning my abuses. This person is not fighting back. What's going on here? And then in their own mind, they're like, oh, I must have said something bad. Maybe I should take that back. So taking that 2-3 second pause allows the other person the opportunity to reflect on what they said, not having to react to what you're going to say or what you would say. And so this is the end of brawls and quarrels. This is how you start to make peace. That is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. Then soon after the Blessed One had gone, the bhikkhus considered, "Now, friends, the Blessed One has risen from his seat and gone into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief, without expanding the detail meaning. Now who will expound this in detail?" Then they considered the Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. He is capable of expounding with detailed meaning. Suppose we went to him and asked him the meaning of this. Then the bhikkhus went to the Venerable Mahakachana and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down to one side and told him what had taken place, adding, "Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it to us." The Venerable Mahakachana replied, "Friends, it is as though a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, thought that heartwood should be sought for among the branches and leaves of a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, after he had passed over the root and the trunk. And so it is with you, venerable sirs, that you think that I should be asked about the meaning of this after the Blessed One by when you were after you passed the Blessed One by when you were face to face with the teacher. For knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees, he is vision, he is knowledge, he is the Dhamma, he is the Holy One, he is the sayer, the proclaimer, the elucidator of meaning, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagat. That was the time when you should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told you, so you should have remembered it. Surely, friend Kachana, knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees, he is vision, he is knowledge, he is the Dhamma, he is the Holy One. He is the sayer, the proclaimer, the elucidator of meaning, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagat. That was the time when we should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told us, so we should have remembered it. Yet the Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. The Venerable Mahakachana is capable of expounding the detailed meaning of the summary given in brief by the Blessed One, without expounding the detailed meaning. Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it without finding it troublesome. So Mahakachana was known to do these kinds of things. He was the one who expounded brief statements by the Buddha and then expand on what that was. Oftentimes you'll see in different suttas where the Buddha is saying something and then he leaves his seat and retires for the day. And then they asked Mahakachana to expound it, to elaborate on it. And he always spoke in terms of consciousness. And you'll see what he does here. Then listen, friends, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend, the bhikkhus replied. The Venerable Mahakachana said this. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling, after giving a summary in brief, without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, bhikkhus, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendencies. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons. Here, these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of it to be as follows. Listen carefully. Dependent on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset one with respect to past, future, present forms cognizable through the eye. So let's unpack that. First, he says, what is contact? Contact is made up of three components: the sense base, the object of the sense base, and the sense base consciousness. The sense base consciousness arises dependent upon the joining of the eye and form, let's say, when it's eye consciousness. These three together denote eye contact. If, like I said yesterday, if the eye is non-functional, then there is no meeting of the eye and form, and therefore no eye consciousness, and there cannot be any contact. But if everything is functional, one can experience, there is the sense-based object, and the meeting of the three is the awareness of the sense-base, then there is contact. That's the initial spark between the sense-base and the sense-base object. From there, there is feeling. Feeling means the seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, the touching, the thinking. This is what feeling is. Any kind of experience to be felt and sensed is feeling, Vedana. Where what one feels, that one perceives. Tied to feeling is perception. Perception is rooted in memory. Perception is the recognition aspect of the mind, that which recognizes what it experienced before. When you have seen the color red before and learned what the name of that color is, the next time you see it, meaning you experience it, and then you perceive it as red. When you learn a certain kind of language, you cognize and learn that language, right? You start to understand that language. You experience the sound waves, start to make sense of that language. Whenever somebody speaks that language, you recognize that that's what that language is and that's what they're saying. That recognition aspect of that is perception. So perception is always tied to feeling. These two are intertwined. In fact, there are three that are intertwining together, which we'll talk about in a couple of days. But that is feeling, perception, and consciousness. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one cognizes. What one cognizes, that one experiences. What one experiences, that one perceives. These three run around each other. Feeling, perception, consciousness. What one perceives, what one recognizes in terms of that experience, one thinks about. What is this thinking about? Judging. Thinking in relation to a sense of I, me, myself. Contemplating. Analyzing. Weighing the options. Is this beneficial for me or not beneficial for me? Comparing. I learned it this way, but I remember some time back, somebody told me about this in a different way. All of these different pondering and thinking. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. There is the potential for proliferation, which is the craving, the identification, rooting the identification in that experience, clinging to it with that sense of I, and then becoming that person who thinks about it, fully rooting the self in it, and then from there acting. With what one mentally proliferates as the source, with what one craves, clings, and becomes as the source. Perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset the person with respect to past, future, and present forms. Perceptions and notions born of that craving, clinging, and becoming. Meaning, views and opinions and ideas and concepts born through that process of craving, clinging, and becoming. Beset one with respect to the past, future, and present forms. The comparison. I experience this now, and there is a comparison from the past. Or there is a looking into the future. Will this experience continue on into the future or not? Or how will I feel when this leaves me? A few days ago, people were asking, what do we do off retreat? Thinking already about what's going to happen at the end of the retreat. Nothing wrong with it, but understand the thought processes that can lead to craving and suffering. And so likewise, dependent upon the ear and sounds, dependent on the nose and odors, dependent on the tongue and flavors, dependent on the body and tangibles, dependent on the mind and mind objects, these sense-based consciousnesses arise. The meeting of the three, the sense-based object, and the sense consciousness, is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future, and present sense objects cognizable through that sense base. Now listen to this. He goes even deeper. When there is the I of form and I consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of contact. In other words, you need a functional I. Like I said earlier, you need a functional I. You need the form. If I close my eye is functional. But I don't see anything beyond my eyelids. There's no form there. So when there is form, there is rupa, there is color, there's form and color. And the eye makes contact with that. When there is that, there is I consciousness. When there are these three, it is possible to denote the contact. In other words, it's possible to recognize where there is contact. When there is the manifestation of contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of feeling, naturally. When there is the sparsha, the touch, the contact, then you can also have the feeling dependent upon that contact. You can denote and see where the feeling is, the experience right here and now. Your eye, your ears are functional. The sound waves are touching your ears, and there is consciousness and awareness of that. And now there is an experience of hearing my voice. Therefore, you can notice or recognize the contact between the sound waves in the ear and the ear consciousness. And then you can also denote the experience of hearing. When there is the manifestation of feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. Not only can you hear the sound, you can recognize what I'm saying in what language and what words I'm using. Perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. You see? You feel and perceive. Everyone feels and perceives. Even arahats, even fully awakened ones, feel and perceive, and even think and reflect. But the way they think and reflect does not relate to a sense of I. That's where the crux is. Noticing how the mind is experiencing something in relation to an I. Noticing if there is a superimposition of a personal self to that experience. When there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. Likewise for the other sense bases. So in other words, at each of these points, it's possible to use right effort to let go. If you see that the mind is thinking about this or that in relation to the past, present, future, thinking about this or that in relation to the I, to the me, you can recognize that. It's possible to point it out. Recognizing that there is that I there and letting it go. So this requires clear awareness. This requires absolutely pristine mindfulness to be able to see what the mind is doing, how the mind is taking in experiences. Is there that tiny little self-concept still present in everything that the mind is thinking about in relation to an experience? And if there is, you can siksar it. You can recognize, oh, I'm starting to take this personally. You relax that. Let go of that. Relax it. Come back to just the witness. Just come back to the awareness of what is happening. Change the wording in your mind if you have to, from I am experiencing this, or this is, I feel this pain, to this is painful. This is a painful experience. Just even that little thing can help you separate the sense of self with the experience. Now he goes even further. He says, when there is no I, no form, and no I consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of contact. When there is no manifestation of contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of feeling. When there is no manifestation of feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. Now, there are a few ways of understanding this. He refers to this when in reference to the eye, in reference to the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind, and its objects and their subsequent consciousnesses or their respective consciousnesses. In the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, there is no more an experience of eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, body consciousness, tongue consciousness, mind consciousness. Therefore, even if the sense organs are there, but there's no awareness of that, there can be no contact which can give rise to further feeling, perception, and so on. But outside of that scope of cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, think about it this way. When there is contact with a hindrance, the mind recognizes that hindrance and it can choose to continue to think about that hindrance, continue to reflect on that hindrance, continue to add and superimpose the sense of I to that hindrance. Or recognizing the experience of the hindrance, changing the trajectory of the mind's focus by using right effort, now there is no more thinking about that. Now there is no more perception of that. Now there is no more mental proliferation about that. So whatever experience you're having, painful, pleasant, neutral, through the sense bases or the mind, if you see craving in relation to it, if you see the mind identifying with it, there is still the possibility of letting go and loosening up that identification using right effort. And that is dependent upon sharp and clear mindfulness. The sharpening of mindfulness is through right effort. Right effort leads to right mindfulness. Right mindfulness leads to right collectedness. These three constitute samadhi. Every time the mindfulness is gone, you come back to right effort, come back to 6 hours, and regain your mindfulness and be able to let go and then experience a more collected mind. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief without expounding the detail meaning, that is, bhikkhu, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold on to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of this summary to be thus. Now, friends, if you wish, go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, so you should remember it. Then the bhikkhus, having delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Mahakachana's words, rose from their seats and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told the Blessed One all that had taken place after he had left, adding, "Then, Venerable Sir, we went to the Venerable Mahakachana and asked him about the meaning." The Venerable Mahakachana expounded the meaning to us with these terms, statements, and phrases. Mahakachana is wise, bhikkhus. Mahakachana has great wisdom. In other words, he has attained. He knows right view. He sees through dependent origination. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that Mahakachana has explained it. Such is the meaning of this, and so you should remember it. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, just as if a man exhausted by hunger and weakness came upon a honey ball, wherever he would taste it, he would find a sweet, delectable flavor. So too, Venerable Sir, any able-minded bhikkhu, wherever he might scrutinize with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma, would find satisfaction and confidence of mind. Venerable sir, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma? As to that, Ananda, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as the Honeyball discourse. You know, when he calls it Honeyball, it makes me think of Gulab Jamun. This is the Gulab Jamun discourse. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. We're going to go through the next sutta, so hold your questions, because this is a continuation of this whole process. Now we're going to guide you through this process in somewhat of a meditation through this sutta. This sutta is Majjhima Nikaya 143, Anathapindikovada Sutta, the advice to Anathapindika. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Now on that occasion the householder Anathapindika was afflicted, suffering and gravely ill. Then he addressed a certain man thus, "Come, good man, go to the Blessed One, pay homage in my name with your head at his feet, and say, Venerable Sir, the householder Anathapindika is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. He pays homage with his head at the Blessed One's feet. Then go to the Venerable Sariputta, pay homage in my name with your head at his feet, and say, Venerable Sir, the householder Anathapindika is afflicted, suffering and gravely ill. He pays homage with his head at the Venerable Sariputta's feet. Then say, it would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Venerable Sariputta would come to the residence of the householder Anathapindika out of compassion." "Yes, sir," the man replied, and he went to the Blessed One. And after paying homage to the Blessed One, he sat down at one side and delivered his message. Then he went to the Venerable Sariputta, and after paying homage to the Venerable Sariputta, he delivered his message, saying, "It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Venerable Sariputta would come to the residence of the householder Anathapindika out of compassion." The Venerable Sariputta consented in silence. Then the Venerable Sariputta dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, went to the residence of the householder Anathapindika, with the Venerable Ananda as his attendant. Having gone there, he sat down on a seat made ready and said to the householder Anathapindika, "I hope you are getting well, householder. I hope you are comfortable. I hope your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that the subsiding and not their increase is apparent." "Venerable Sariputta, I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent. Just as if a strong man were splitting my head open with a sharp sword, so too, while violent winds cut through my head, I am not getting well. Just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband, so too there are violent pains in my head. I am not getting well. Just as a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife, so too violent winds are carving up my belly. I am not getting well. Just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals, so too there is a violent burning in my body. I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. My painful feelings are increasing, not subsiding. Their increase and not their subsiding is apparent." Now, take a moment, relax, and just close your eyes and listen to the rest of the sutta. I will be reading what Sariputta is saying, and then I will be elaborating on it. Let my words just guide you through the process. Householder Then, householder, you should train thus. I will not cling to the eye, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the eye. I will not cling to the ear, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the ear. I will not cling to the nose, and my consciousness will not cling to the nose, be dependent on the nose. I will not cling to the tongue, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the tongue. I will not cling to the body, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the body. I will not cling to the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the mind. In other words, I will not cling to the sense bases. I see the sense bases for what they actually are. These sense bases are not me, not mine, not myself. My consciousness, my awareness is not tied to these sense bases. My consciousness resides independent of these sense bases. I will not cling to forms, and my consciousness will not be dependent on forms. I will not cling to sounds, and my consciousness will not be dependent on sounds. I will not cling to odors, and my consciousness will not be dependent on odors. I will not cling to flavors, and my consciousness will not be dependent on flavors. I will not cling to tangibles, and my consciousness will not be dependent on tangibles. I will not cling to mind objects, and my consciousness will not be dependent on mind objects. Everything that is an object of the sense bases, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, mind objects, thoughts, all of that I do not see as me, mine, or myself. There is no superimposition of I, me, or mine to these sense-based objects. And the awareness of these sense objects are not dependent upon them. The awareness is not tied to them. The awareness is independent of them. They are aware, the awareness is aware of these sense-based objects. And because they are just aware, they are not the sense-based objects. The awareness of something does not mean that you are that. I will not cling to I consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on I consciousness. I will not cling to your consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on your consciousness. I will not cling to nose consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on nose consciousness. I will not cling to tongue consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on tongue consciousness. I will not cling to body consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent upon body consciousness. I will not cling to mind consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on mind consciousness. Even the awareness of the sense-based experiences, that awareness is not me, not mine, not myself. That awareness arises dependent upon the sense-based and the sense-based object. See the awareness of the awareness of the sense-based objects, and see that they are not tied to the sense-based objects. They are not tied to the awarenesses of each of these sense-based objects. They are independent of this awareness. I will not cling to eye contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on eye contact. I will not cling to ear contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on eye contact. I will not cling to nose contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on nose contact. I will not cling to tongue contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on tongue contact. I will not cling to body contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on body contact. I will not cling to mind contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on mind contact. Even the initial spark, the touch, the sparsha, the spark between the eye and form. When you are hearing my voice, the sound of my voice and the ear consciousness, which denotes the ear contact. The awareness of that is independent, not dependent on the contact. The fact that you can be aware of this contact shows that that contact is not you. That contact is not me, mine, or myself. I will not cling to feeling born of eye contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on feeling born of eye contact. I will not cling to feeling born of ear contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on feeling born of ear contact. I will not cling to feeling born of nose contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the feeling born of nose contact. I will not cling to feeling born of tongue contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the feeling born of tongue contact. I will not cling to the feeling born of body contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the feeling born of body contact. I will not cling to feeling born of mind contact, and my consciousness will not be dependent on feeling born of mind contact. The awareness of the experience itself. Now you're aware that that experience is not me, not mine, not myself. The fact that you can see this shows that your awareness is independent of these experiences themselves. When you hear my voice, that is dependent upon contact with the voice and your ears and your consciousness. Dependent upon that, there is the experience of the sound. Because you are aware of that, you know that this is not me, not mine, not myself. I will not cling to material form, and my consciousness will not be dependent upon material form. I will not cling to feeling, and my consciousness will not be dependent on feeling. I will not cling to perception, and my consciousness will not be dependent upon perception. I will not cling to formations, and my consciousness will not be dependent on formations. I will not cling to consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on consciousness. Your material form, the body, is made up of the four great states of matter, the four great elements. That has nothing to do with you, has nothing to do with me, mine, or myself. The awareness of this body also has nothing to do with me, mine, or myself. All experiences that you are having, all feeling that you are having and experiencing, that is dependent upon causes and conditions, not dependent upon a me, mine, or myself. The awareness of that itself also is not tied to it. It is independent of the experience. All perceptions, all concepts, all views, all opinions that you have in mind, they arose dependent upon previous circumstances, previous situations, having nothing to do with the me, mine, or myself. And your awareness of them shows to the mind that it has nothing to do with the me, mine, or myself. All formations and intentions that you had in the past, they arose dependent upon contact with the outside world. The choices and decisions that were made, they arose dependent upon the choices that were presented, having nothing to do with the me, mine, or myself. And the awareness of this is independent from that. The awareness of awareness itself, the fact that you can see the awareness, the fact that you can experience the awareness, shows that that awareness also is not you, is not me, not mine, not myself. Anything that can be observed is not me, not mine, not myself. And if you can observe the observer as well, that observer is not me, not mine, not myself. The observer is dependent on the observation and the object of observation. Seeing this, let go of any notions of me, mine, or myself to that observation and the process of the observer. I will not cling to the base of infinite space, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the base of infinite space. I will not cling to the base of infinite consciousness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the base of infinite consciousness. I will not cling to the base of nothingness, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the base of nothingness. I will not cling to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the base of neither perception nor non-perception. In other words, even the meditation itself is a process of observing. Whether it's the jhanic factors, whether it's the loving kindness, whether it's the spiritual friend, whether it's the intention to radiate loving kindness, radiate compassion, radiate equanimity, radiate joy, whether it's the experience of infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, neither perception or non-perception, all this is observed. And that which can be observed and experienced is not me, not mine, not myself. I will not cling to this world, and my consciousness will not be dependent on this world. I will not cling to the world beyond, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the world beyond. I will not cling to what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought after, and examined by the mind, and my consciousness will not be dependent on that. In other words, in the seeing, there is only the seen. In the hearing, there is only the process of hearing. In the thinking, there is only the process of thinking. In the cognizing, there is only the process of cognizing. In the perceiving, there is only the process of perceiving. See this, and see that the I is not present in it. There is only an impersonal process of thinking, feeling, perceiving, seeing, tasting, hearing, touching, and processing. The consciousness that is aware of this process, that too is dependent upon these experiences. I will not cling to the earth element, and my consciousness will not be dependent upon the earth element. I will not cling to the water element, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the water element. I will not cling to the fire element, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the fire element. I will not cling to the air element, and my consciousness will not be dependent upon the air element. I will not cling to the space element, and my consciousness will not be dependent upon the space element. I will not cling to the consciousness element, and my consciousness will not be dependent on the consciousness element. These elements, the earth element, the water element, the air element, the fire element, the space element, the consciousness element. The earth element is the solidity of the body. That has nothing to do with the me, mine, or myself. The water element has to do with liquidity of the body. The blood, the sweat, the tears, all of the liquid aspects of the body. They arise dependent upon bodily causes and conditions. There is no control from the sense of me, mine, or myself. The fire element, when you think about the fire element, the heat in the body, that is only dependent upon bodily causes and conditions, reacting to external circumstances. The air element, the winds going through the body, the breathing in and out, that is not even controlled either. Even the conscious inhalation and exhalation, that is dependent upon bodily causes and conditions. See it to be not me, not mine, not myself. The space element of the body, the different spaces in the body, the ear canal, the nostrils, and so on, the mouth, all of that is just space, nothing to do with the me, mine, or myself. The consciousness element, that is the mind itself and the factors of the mind, the contact, feeling, perception, intention, attention, that has nothing to do with the me, mine, or myself. And the consciousness that resides dependent upon the mind, that too, because of the fact that it is dependent upon it, is not me, not mine, not myself. Thus you should train. When this was said, the householder Anathapindika wept and shed tears. Then the Venerable Ananda asked him, "Are you foundering, householder? Are you sinking?" "I am not foundering, Venerable Ananda. I am not sinking. But although I have waited long upon the teacher and bhikkhus worthy of esteem, never before have I heard such a talk on the Dhamma." Such talk on the Dhamma, householder, is not given to lay people clothed in white. Such talk on the Dhamma is given to those who have gone forth. This does not mean that this is a secret teaching. All that Sariputta is saying is that this teaching is given to those who have renounced the world. And lay people are busy in their own duties and activities. So primarily it's not given. "Well then, Venerable Sariputta, let such talk on the Dhamma be given to lay people clothed in white. There are clansmen with little dust in their eyes who are wasting away through not hearing such talk on the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma." Then, after having given the householders Anathapindika this advice, the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Ananda rose from their seats and departed. Soon after they had left, the householder Anathapindika died and reappeared in the Tusita heaven. Then, when the night was well advanced, Anathapindika, now a young god of beautiful appearance, went to the Blessed One, illuminating the whole of Jetta's Grove. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he stood at one side and addressed the Blessed One in stanzas. "O blessed is this Jetta's Grove, dwelt in by the sagely Sangha, wherein resides the King of Dhamma, the fount of all happiness. By action, knowledge, and Dhamma, by virtue and noble way of life, by these are mortals purified, not by lineage or wealth, by action, by intention, by knowledge, by wisdom, by the Dhamma, by keeping the precepts and following the Eightfold Path. This is how the mind is purified. Therefore, a wise person who sees what truly leads to his own good should investigate and understand the Dhamma and purify himself with it. Sariputta has reached the peak in virtue, that is sila, peace, samadhi, and wisdom's ways, panya. Any bhikkhu who has gone beyond at best can only equal him." That is what the young god Anathapindika said, and the teacher approved. When the young god Anathapindika, thinking the teacher has approved of me, paid homage, then the young god Anathapindika, thinking the teacher has approved of me, paid homage to the Blessed One, and keeping him on his right, he vanished at once. When the night had ended, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus: "Bhikkhus, last night, when the night was well advanced, there came to me a certain young god of beautiful appearance, who illuminated the whole of Jetta's Grove. After paying homage to me, he sat down on one side and addressed me in stanzas. Then the young god, thinking the teacher has approved of me, paid homage to me, and keeping me on his right, he vanished at once. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, 'Surely, Venerable Sir, that young god must have been Anathapindika.' For the householder Anathapindika had perfect confidence in the Venerable Sariputta." "Good, good, Ananda. As far as reasoning goes, you have withdrawn the right conclusion. That young god was Anathapindika, no one else." This is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words.